From the studios of EWTN, this is Open Line with today's host, Father John Trigilio. In North America, call toll-free 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. Or send an email to openline@ewtn.com.
A tremendous Monday to each and every one of you. Thanks so much for tuning in to EWTN's Open Line. If you'd like to be part of the program, I suggest you grab one of these open phone lines now before they fill up. The toll-free number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, that number is 1-205-271-2985. And we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. You can always send us an email. That email address is openline@ewtn.com. I'm Jack Williams, Michael McCall producing the program. Your call screener is Matt Gubensky and Ace McKay handling our social media efforts. So if you're watching us on YouTube, you can type a question into the chat window and it may find its way to us by the end of the program. And our host, as he is every Monday, Father John Trigilio, coming to you from just outside the city gate in Rome, apparently.
Yeah, I have a little shortcut here.
Father, how are you?
I'm doing well. Good to be with you again.
So I've got an email here from Karen, who listens at Annunciation Radio in Bowling Green, Ohio. She said, "Today, while the gospel was being read, I had a light bulb moment. The reading was from the 6th chapter of John, verse 41. The Jews then murmured at him because he said, 'I am the bread which came down from heaven.' They said, 'Is not this Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know?' I suddenly realized that they were speaking as if Joseph was still alive. Since we don't know when Joseph died, could it be possible that at the very beginning of Jesus' ministry he was still living? Or perhaps he had died just before and people were not yet aware of his passing. Is it possible that Jesus began his ministry in conjunction with Joseph's passing? Just some thoughts that suddenly struck me. What do you think?"
Well, I don't know if it's a fluorescent or an incandescent bulb that went off over her head. We don't know with moral certitude, let alone metaphysical certitude, when precisely St. Joseph died. It is presumed with good thinking that he probably died just before Jesus started his public ministry, which would make a wonderful transition so that up until the time Jesus was 33, he would have been, or his beginning of his public ministry, that he probably stayed with Mary and Joseph. And then once St. Joseph passed away, then Jesus goes on his own into his public ministry, goes into the desert for 40 days and 40 nights, and then starts. The rest of that time beforehand, he was in the carpenter's shop with him. But we don't have a death certificate for St. Joseph. And when you refer to him after his postmortem, that's how they spoke about things. That, you know, they're not as precise in ancient Hebrew or Aramaic, let alone in ancient Greek, the way we are in modern English. So we use a bunch of different ways of different verbs to use, refer to someone past tense, pluperfect, all that. They didn't have that back then. So the fact that it didn't say his former father or anything like that, we can't read in between the lines. But in terms of De Fide, you could still hold that he was alive well into Jesus's ministry for 3 years. But the church has not decided upon it. I tend to think he died, and that would make more sense that Jesus, at the wedding feast of Cana, Joseph is conspicuously missing.
Yeah, I think without documentation, it would be all speculation. And this is speculation too. However, There is some evidence, I think, when I don't recall, you may can correct me, Father, I don't think I've ever seen a relic of St. Joseph.
I've seen one, but not of his. they said it was a part of his staff or a part of his closet. You go to Italy, there's a relic for almost everyone.
I think you can, but not a first-class relic.
Not first-class, no.
So, which I think that you could make a better case that maybe he was assumed.
Someone asked me that recently, and I said it could have happened. There's no biblical or sacred tradition to support it, but there's nothing that would deny it. Certainly, he was born in original sin, and he needed redemption, as did everyone else. I like the thought that that one of the first persons Jesus released or let into heaven after he died on Good Friday would have been St. Joseph, right along with Adam and Eve.
Although, you know, that could be one of the fringe benefits of having a foster son who's outside of time and space.
Yes, you could say. Don't forget your dad.
833-288-EWTN. Grab one of these open phone lines at 833-288-3986. Ray writes in, is it correct to say Jesus is a human being based on 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 21, that says, for as by a man came death, by a man has come also the resurrection of the dead reference?
Well, certainly the Council of Nicaea, the Council of Ephesus, and the Council of Chalcedon make it very clear that it is solemn dogma. Jesus Christ is one divine person with two natures, a human nature and divine nature. And he's not like Mr. Spock, half and half. He's fully human, fully divine. That's the mystery. So in his humanity, in his human nature, he has a body and a soul. And in his soul, he has a human intellect and a human will. But that's also hypostatically united to his divine nature, which is has the divine intellect and a divine will. So when we speak of Jesus, we can say human being insofar as, yes, true God, true man, but I always say it's important to emphasize he's one divine person with two natures.
And that will actually go a long way towards answering Jack's question, who writes in, is it wrong to say the incarnation is below God? Yes.
Absolutely, yes, because you're dealing with the second person of the Trinity. Now, it's true, some people get confused, as did Arius, who was a heretic in the ancient church, that said because Jesus had a created human nature, he was inferior to God the Father, and so he came up with this idea that the Son was like homoousios, but not the same substance, homoousios, and that's why when Pope Benedict tweaked the English translation of the Roman Missal, we correctly changed it from one in being to consubstantial. It's the same substance that Jesus shares with the Father. So even though his humanity, his human nature was created in time, he, the person who Jesus is always divine. That means he is eternal.
You know, I often wish Mother Angelica had been alive during the time of some of these guys, because I would have loved to have heard her just look at them and say, that doesn't make any sense.
I could see her doing that.
Maddie wants to know, why do you have to be baptized to go to heaven?
Because Jesus said so. Unless you're born again of water and the Spirit. And baptism, remember, the most obvious form is the sacramental form by with water and the invocation of the Holy Trinity. I baptize you in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. There's also the baptism by blood, which some of the early martyrs died before they could be physically baptized. And there's a baptism of desire, that there are those who want or would have wanted to be baptized, but they were prevented from doing so beyond their control. Therefore, you know, it keeps intact. And again, you know, Pope Benedict made this extremely clear. It's in the catechism. Baptism is necessary, but there are three forms of baptism. So baptism by water and the invocation of the Trinity is the best way, because then you have access to the other sacraments. But the other two are just as valid, baptism by blood or baptism by desire.
833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. Straight ahead, we'll talk to Andy in West Virginia, and we've got plenty of time for your calls at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. And you can also text your question to Father Trigilio. Just simply text the letters EWTN to the address 58177, wait for our response, and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. And Mr. McCall is hot on the text line as we speak. So text EWTN to 58177, wait for our response, text us your first name and your question. Message and data rates may apply. 833-288-3986. It's EWTN's Open Line Monday with Father John Trigilio.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. If you have a question, call 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. Or send us an email to openline@ewtn.com.
You know, here at EWTN, we're committed to spreading the gospel from a Catholic perspective, touching millions via television, radio, publishing, and the internet. Right now, EWTN is looking for qualified people to fill a number of exciting positions. Make a difference using your God-given talent. Visit EWTN.com/employment today. As advertised, first up today is Andy, a first-time caller in the great state of West Virginia, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Andy, you are on with Father John Trigilio.
Good afternoon, and thanks. And Father, I received a rosary as a gift that I use to pray my daily rosary. Not sure if it's blessed or not, but I had someone tell me, you ought to get that blessed. Does a blessing, and I'm using air quotes, activate a rosary? And maybe the same thing, say, for religious medals and scapulars and so forth. Do they need to be blessed?
Well, they certainly can be used if they're not blessed. So it's not something necessary for you to be able to use it. However, when you do get a rosary or scapular blessed, what happens is it becomes a sacramental, not a sacrament, but a sacramental, which means actual grace is available. You can even receive a partial indulgence when you pray, say, the rosary for the Blessed Sacrament. So getting something like that blessed, a medal or a rosary or a crucifix, even a Bible, gives you more advantage, but you can still use it, wear it, even if it's not. So it's not, you're not, it's not, activate, I can understand, because people understand that technology today. Like when you get software, if you don't activate it, it reminds you every 30 days, you did not activate your program yet. But by all means, next time you go to church, bring it to a priest or deacon, and they'll be happy to bless it for you.
How's that, Andy?
Sounds good. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome. We appreciate the phone call today. 833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number. Wide open phone lines for you at 833-288-3986. I know many of you are busy with a lot of people returning to school this week. The first chapter of the book I've been working on for 12 years, Father, is going to be entitled America Was Better When... And the first chapter is going to be dedicated to America Was Better When Students Went to School from Labor Day to Memorial Day.
I concur completely.
833-288-3986. Vance wants to know, what is the difference between personal sin and original sin?
Well, original sin was the sin of Adam and Eve, and it is then inherited by every human being since them, other than Jesus and the Blessed Mother, because she was protected by the Immaculate Conception. But the rest of us, we inherit original sin. Personal sin, or what we more accurately call actual sin, is the sin that you and I commit when we purposely, intentionally, knowingly break one of the commandments, when we do what we know is wrong, then that is an actual sin. Original sin is we inherit and we need to get that removed by baptism. Actual sin, if it's venial, any of the sacramentals remit it. So you bless yourself with holy water or read a passage of the sacred scripture, you can get that remitted. Mortal sin can only be remitted in the sacrament of confession. One must go to the penance and receive that from the priest.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Three lines taken, three lines open at 833-288-3986. All right, fasten your seatbelt, Father. Jared wants to know, am I right in saying one reason for Pope Francis's issuing his Latin Mass document was that he felt traditional Catholics were being too arrogant or legalistic?
I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know why the Holy Father, or you know, whether it was Pope Benedict or Pope Francis. It's not a good game to impute motives. We just know what he wrote and what the current structure is. It's not good to say, well, was he thinking about this? Was this his agenda? I really don't know. All I know is that's the current law. And remember, this is not an article of faith. But out of obedience, because the papal primacy, the Pope is supreme pontiff, we have to obey things even if we don't necessarily like or agree with them. But when it comes to faith and morals, like with the Immaculate Conception and the Assumption, which were respectively defined by Pope Pius IX and Pope Pius XII, I have no leeway in that. I have to accept, give full assent of intellect and will, whereas in terms of his jurisdiction, his disciplinary authority, that's he's entitled to do that. So I wouldn't want to speculate. A lot of people are trying to do that these days, and it's an area to be very careful about. Now, you can hypothesize and say this might be a reason why someone would do that. You may say, but that's not a good enough reason. Always in the hypothetical, but to be definitive and say, this is what's going on, you have to find, you have to ascertain that by the person whom you are saying is coming up with this.
Now, I think it is fair to say that he put a lot of emphasis on the legitimacy of the Second Vatican Council and the legitimacy of the Novus Ordo Mass in the document, and I say that's pretty safe ground to stay on. Because unfortunately, there are some that claim to be within our ranks that are questioning the legitimacy of either one or both of them, and that's not a good place to be.
No, you have to completely agree and consent to the fact that since Vatican II, my holy orders are valid, the masses I've been celebrating are valid. What I don't like is when it goes to either extreme, where you've got what they would call rad-trads who say the Novus Ordo is invalid, that's wrong. Then you've got the other people who say anyone who likes the traditional, especially extraordinary form, they must be schismatic, that's wrong. So you got to avoid the extremes at all costs.
Father Wade on Tuesdays is always preaching the Via Media, the middle road, and being with the church, cum ecclesia, not
that's
supra.
Right.
Or sub-ecclesia, but with the church. 833-288-EWTN. Still a couple of open lines for you. Kathy is in St. Louis, Missouri, listening on Covenant Radio. Kathy, you are on with Father John Trigilio.
Hi.
Hello.
I had a question. I heard you mention indulgences earlier in relation to sacramentals. And I was wondering if you could explain that a little better.
Okay, exactly. If you, at least in recent times, since I've been born, if you look inside like the New American Bible or the Douay Rheims Bible, the Revised Standard, you will often see a little passage in there that an indulgence is available for anyone who reads this Bible. The Bible itself is considered a sacramental. It's not a sacrament. There's only seven of those. and those confer sanctifying grace, whereas the sacramentals were not created by Jesus directly. They were given to us by the church. And the sacramentals like holy water, the rosary, the scapular, crucifix, these things are potential for conveying a plenary indulgence, but under the normal conditions. That means the person who wants to receive the partial indulgence, or in some cases a plenary indulgence, which is the full remission of temporal punishment due to sin, to obtain that, you must go to confession 20 days before or after. You must receive Holy Communion. You must pray for the intention of the Holy Father and Our Father, Hail Mary, Glory Be, or the Apostles' Creed. And for a plenary indulgence, you must be free from all attachment, even to venial sin. So if all those conditions are present, then a person does, in fact, gain the indulgence. If it's not a plenary indulgence, it's at least a partial indulgence. But those are all based on the contingency that the person's properly disposed. So it's not just having the thing or doing the deed. You must also be properly disposed in order to gain that. That's why in the Middle Ages, when there were some unscrupulous, devious people who were wrongly trying to sell indulgences, just the very fact that you're trying to sell or buy them invalidates it, because you know it's all contingent on the fact you're doing this with the right intent, and you're doing this in the right way, and that was not.
Does that clear it up, Kathy, a little bit?
So an indulgence is a forgiveness of sin?
No, it's the punishment due to sin. So going to confession to get rid of mortal sin, being sorry or contrite, you can remit your venial sin. But the punishment due to sin is what the indulgence takes care of. It's that temporal punishment due to sin. It's like when I threw the baseball through the window, I had to say to my dad, I'm sorry. But then guess what? I had to help pay to have it replaced.
Thanks, Kathy. We appreciate the phone call today. 833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. Next stop is Alaska. Ann is a first-time listener listening on KHRA Radio. Ann has got a my kind of question for you, Father Trujillo. Ann, you're on with Father John.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Hello. Of course, we don't know when the good Lord's coming, our time, but it refers to the Bible, or in the Bible, that the signs, he's going to give us signs that he's near. And so what I'm reading is those signs are catastrophes, disease, war, word of war, etc. And so via that, we're pretty much all of that is going on everywhere these days. Do you think, in your opinion, that God is really near now?
Well, he could be. I mean, certainly you're right. It says in the scripture that there'll be signs and omens predispose us to the fact that this second coming of Christ is about to take place, the end of the world, then followed by the resurrection of the dead and the general judgment. However, Jesus also says, you know not the day nor the hour. So we cannot be precise. We cannot have moral certitude that this is the precise day, the moment that the world's going to end. But we do know the world will end. And certainly when you go back in time to World War I, World War II, during the Cold War, I remember to the missiles of October, I was just an infant at the time, but my mom and dad said they thought World War III was going to take place when the Russians put nuclear missiles in Cuba. So many instances where they looked as if it could be. That doesn't mean that it could not. I mean, it may have had the potential to happen then, but we just don't know the precise time and moment. The signs that are there are not there to scare us. There to help prepare us.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. It's Open Line Monday with Father John Trujillo.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Congratulations going out to two more members of the EWTN Radio family. New Hampshire Catholic Radio is celebrating 9 years with EWTN, and St. Rose Radio in Murfreesboro, Tennessee marks 8 years with EWTN. Congratulations to Father Ray Ball and Mike Bellino in Concord, New Hampshire, as well as Richard Richard and Billy Trout in Murfreesboro from your friends here at EWTN. 833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number. Grab one of these open phone lines at 833-288-3986. Pete wants to know, does RCIA duration delay people's salvation?
No. And by the way, it's no longer RCIA, it's now OCIA. The rite of Christian initiation of adults has been changed here in the English-speaking world into the order of the Christian initiation of adults. Just a minor technicality. The process, the convert process, as we used to call it, again, I mentioned it before, the baptism of desire, if someone who's not baptized is in the OCIA, if, God forbid, they die before they get to be baptized, because if you're going through the parish program, it's typical that you'll be baptized and confirmed at the Easter Vigil. If something happens to you, you would have had that baptism of desire. Obviously, if someone is ill and there's special circumstances, the priest or the pastor can baptize you earlier. And some people just, they're not able to go through that program. So the pastor has a discretion based on his diocese of giving the person personal instruction and then having them baptized at a convenient time. So you're not putting yourself in jeopardy because of the usually takes several months to go through that process.
833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Linda wants to know, how far is too far regarding honoring a saint?
Well,
it's not where you thought she was going, is it?
Yes, I have to admit that. I thought she was talking about, you know, GPS and driving
exactly.
Between Columbus, Ohio and Emmitsburg, Maryland.
Yeah, that's it.
Where the line has to be drawn is that we give the saints what we call dulia, which is honor. Mary gets the highest honor. She gets hyperdulia. And God alone gets latria, which is adoration and worship. So obviously we cannot worship the saints, and we cannot give them hyperdulia. That's reserved to the Virgin Mary. But we can give them honor. And honor, reverence, certainly, you know, we're told to honor our father and mother, and that's a commandment. That's not an option. So honoring the saints is giving reverence to who they were, the fact that they are a friend of God, that as a saint they're in the presence of God, they have the beatific vision. Where you have to draw the line is where you make them equal to or superior to the Virgin Mary, that would then negate her hyperdulia, and then worst case scenario that you would actually adore or worship them. We do not, and some people propose that by saying, well, you have statues. Well, a statue does not always mean that someone that you're worshiping. You go to Washington, D.C., nobody's worshiping Thomas Jefferson or George Washington or Abraham Lincoln. Those are statues. When someone has a nativity set out on their front lawn, are they worshiping the shepherds? No. The cow? No. That's part of the nativity set. They're statues. That's not idolatry.
It depends on where the cow is, I guess, but 833-288.
The golden cow is a different matter.
There you go. 833-288-3986. Wide open phone lines for you at 833-288-3986. Paul writes in, very serious question here. I am divorced and haven't had an annulment. Am I excommunicated? It lays very heavy on my heart.
Yeah, the fact that you're divorced does not make you excommunicated. That was not always the case in the United States, because at one time when we had a lot of immigrants coming to America from Catholic parts of Europe where there was no civil divorce, you were either – you got the decree of annulment or you were not. The American bishops asked Rome, could they impose the penalty of excommunication, which only lasted for a certain amount of time. but especially since the 1983 Code of Canon Law, divorce in and of itself does not excommunicate someone. It's only when someone is civilly divorced, they were validly married, they get civilly divorced, and now they're remarried invalidly. Even then, they're not excommunicated, but they're not able to receive the sacraments. They need to get that resolved by hopefully getting an annulment and then getting their current marriage convalidated. But just divorce in and of itself does not incur the excommunication. Now, that being said, we're not encouraging people to get divorced, but sometimes that's the only alternative. Let's say there's a man who's abusive to his wife and children. They need divorce to protect the kids and, you know, for sustaining them financially. But again, neither one can remarry in the eyes of the church until that annulment's issued. But this particular person, if you're just divorced, you're able to receive communion, you're able to go to the sacraments. I would not, the only thing I caution people who are divorced, don't date anyone until you get that decree of nullity, because then that could put you in a predicament.
And Andrew wants to know, what's the biblical rebuttal to predestination?
Well, there is a Catholic form of predestination. The church condemns is the John Calvin absolute predestination, where God specifically decides some are going to heaven, some are going to hell. Well, that sort of negates human free will. God does not directly ordain someone to go to hell. He does, in some cases, his ordained will is that some would go to heaven. That doesn't mean those who do not had no choice. People by their decisions place themselves in hell. But the biblical way of looking at predestination is to see that salvation is open for everyone. So the potential, or as St. Augustine would say, it's potential for everybody to be saved, but they have to cooperate with it. Okay, it's efficacious to those who cooperate with God's grace.
Still time for your calls. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. Next stop is the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Jimmy is listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Jimmy, welcome to the program. You're on with Father Trujillo.
Hi, Father Trujillo. It's Jimmy from Massachusetts.
Hi.
Are you there, Father?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Father. My question is, was Jesus pure spirit before he was born into the world because he said God the Father is spirit? And also, I'm curious about, I know with my brain I can drive my car, but my mind is receiving information all the time. Is it influenced by both sides? And if I'm patient, I usually make the right decision. But is there an influence coming from both sides, we'll call it?
Okay, well, we'll deal with the first one first. Jesus in his divinity always existed because he's the second person of the Trinity. And as God, he is pure spirit. His human nature, his humanity was created in time at the moment of the incarnation, which was 9 months before his physical birth at Christmas. So his humanity had a beginning in time, but his divinity, his divine nature, being pure spirit, had always existed because he is God. He's the second person of the divine Trinity. He is essence, existence itself. So that takes care of that. In terms of the intellect and the will, what we know in our mind, we use the word mind sometimes indiscriminately with intellect. It's a philosophical concept. The intellect or the mind is that part of us that thinks, knowledge. Will is sometimes referred to as the heart. It's that part of us that makes decisions, choices. We can only choose what we know in our intellect. Therefore, the more you know, the more knowledge you have, the more free you are. Because if you only know A and B, well, you can't choose C. You don't know about C. But if I know A through Z, I can choose any one of those options. So the more knowledge, the more truth I know, the freer I become. And then my freedom is not absolute in the sense I could do whatever I want, but I'm free to choose what's good for me. That's what Pope John Paul made very clear in Veritatis Splendor, the splendor of truth. It was an encyclical letter that the freer, I mean, being free doesn't mean I can do whatever I want. It's not liberty to become a despot. Free means I'm able to make the right choice freely, that no one is forcing me to make this right choice, but that I am oriented, I've created to do and choose what is good.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. Still plenty of time for your calls. Andy wants to know, why did Jesus not allow Mary Magdalene to touch him, but allowed Thomas to touch him?
That's something you could ask Jesus when you see him. We don't have a definitive de fide. It's not something by dogma. There is, again, there's theological speculation that he was telling Mary Magdalene, "Noli me tangere," in the Latin, "Do not cling to me." It wasn't that she was somehow impure or unworthy, but she was not one of the 12 apostles. St. Thomas, as an apostle, would go out and proclaim the good news, and he needed to be convinced in order for him to be a credible witness. Now, Mary Magdalene has been given the title Apostle to the Apostles. That's analogous. It's not something official that she then got a certificate in the mail saying that she's now one of the bishops. But when Jesus says, "Do not cling to me," it's similar to what Jesus said when he raised Lazarus from the dead, "Untie him and let him go." It was a physical command, but also it was an emotional thing that, you know, we should not be so attached to our beloved dead that we won't let them go back home to God. Likewise, he's saying to Mary Magdalene, you know, "Do not cling to me, because I'm not here permanently. I have to go ascend to my Father in heaven, and then you and I have to do our work here on earth." So it's not, the emphasis is not so much on the physicality, that he didn't want Mary Magdalene to touch him, but he wanted St. Thomas. It's the context of when he says those things.
EWTN Radio Extra is the past, present, and future of Catholic radio. You'll hear classic programs from Mother Angelica and Dr. Scott Hahn, timeless devotionals, and award-winning podcasts from our partners on EWTN's Podcast Central. Listen to EWTN Radio Extra on the EWTN app or at EWTN.com. 833-288-EWTN. We can still squeeze in a couple phone calls at 833-288-3986. Put on your Father Spitzer Beretta, Father.
That's a heavy one.
That's a heavy one. Sarah wants to know, what's the best defense for the Shroud of Turin being legitimate?
The best defense is that it is corroborated by many things, like where the nail marks are on the Shroud of Turin. They're in the wrist. They're not in the palm, because if they're in the palm, you know, he would have been torn off the crucifix by sheer weight. So it coincides with what we know through medicine. The blood type, the scientific knowledge or evidence is clear that it corroborates, but science cannot prove that it is Jesus' image on there, but it also cannot substantiate, or they cannot repudiate it. Certainly, if you go to EWTN, especially at the shrine in Hansville, Mother Angelica's shrine to the Holy Eucharist, there's a wonderful display there of the shroud and a lot of information. Father Spitzer's done a number of programs on that. I've run into a few experts on the shroud. And so the wound marks, the blood type, they all coincide with medical evidence that would say this is what kind of injuries this person was inflicted with, that there were nail marks, hands and feet, crown of thorns on the head. In terms of DNA, I don't know, because, you know, this thing is 2,000 years old. I'm not up to date with anything like that, but I do know were able to ascertain a number of things. So science cannot repudiate it, in many ways, it does corroborate what you know.
Larry is a first-time caller in Kirkland, Washington, listening on our great affiliate, Sacred Heart Radio. Larry, you're on with Father Trujillo.
Yes, hello, Father Trujillo.
Hi.
Sort of related to the lady that was asking about the end time. And does the Catholic Church recognize the coming back of the Jews and the Hebrews to Israel in 1948 as the major sign of the end time?
Well, it certainly is a component, because this is not de fide dogma, but it's a theological opinion that's highly regarded, that part of the things of evidence that the end times are approaching, or at least is the potential, is the return of the Jews to the Holy Land. That's one of the things that would be a sign. Now, the fact that they established their own country, that can be interpreted, but that's not de fide. It's not something you could say, I, as a Catholic, have to believe that. And then again, what are the territorial confines? Where does the state of Israel begin and end? Where does the state of Palestine, Egypt, Jordan, and all that? Those are all prudential judgments which have no direct influence on the theological. But the fact that the Jewish people have a homeland is certainly a part of that component that we believe makes sense. But it's not the same level as the second coming of Christ, the resurrection of the dead, the end of the world, and the general judgment. That's part of dogma that we must believe.
Thomas is also a first-time caller in Fredericksburg, Virginia, listening on Sacred Heart Radio online. Thomas, you're on with Father John Trujillo.
Hi, Father. My best friend died a little while ago. He was Jewish and a great person. And, you know, he said, Tom, when you die, it's over. How did Jews go to heaven? They don't know Jesus, and they've actually never been exposed to him. So what happened to this guy? He was a great, great person. Oh.
Well, that's a good question, and we leave that to the mercy of God, because we don't know what happens that last, very last second before a person dies, because even though they may be unconscious to the world, they still have an intellect and a will. And so a number of theologians have proposed the possibility that in many cases, especially a good person, a virtuous person who dies, is given that last chance to accept Christ or to reject him. We know that no one is going to be penalized for what they do not know. You know, the fact that we say that a person must accept Christ, they must, you know, accept the Catholic Church, that's all contingent on the fact that you know you must accept and believe that. So if someone has erroneous information, that's not culpable to them, that they don't know it and they don't have the ability to inform themselves. So yes, it is possible, because Pope Benedict made that very clear in a document that he wrote as Cardinal Ratzinger, later approved by Pope John Paul, Dominus Jesus, that it is true that all salvation comes through Christ and through his church. However, there are some who, through no fault of their own, are unaware of that. So if someone of the Jewish faith is, you know, faithful to the covenant, and it's not their fault, they don't know, they have not rejected what is truly Christ. They may reject what they believe erroneously, in the same way we got non-Catholics who think that we as Catholics worship Mary. We don't. But if that's what they truly believe, they're wrong. Our job is to hopefully prove, inform them otherwise. So yes, it is possible for someone to be saved, but it's saved through Christ. That's always the definitive moment there, is that either in this life or maybe just before they die, that is established.
Thomas, are you familiar with the Diary of St. Faustina?
I've heard of it. I don't have it, though. It
might be a good thing to pick up, because if nothing else, I think it might give you a clearer understanding of just how vast God's mercy is, and I think might bring you some comfort when you're thinking about your friend. God bless you. We appreciate the phone call today. Frank is up next in Parkersburg, West Virginia, listening on St. Paul Radio. Frank, you're on with Father Trujillo.
Hello?
Hello.
Yes. My question was a two-part. It was who and when is responsible for the Catholic annulment, and how is the marriage annulment justified?
Okay, that's a very good question. The annulment is, it's not the equivalent of a civil divorce. A divorce is the state, say the state of Pennsylvania or whatever, says a marriage was legal. They had a marriage license that was legal, and now the divorce says the marriage is ended. That's the civil entity. An annulment says that there was no marriage from the very beginning. There was no sacrament of marriage. And so what it does is it investigates that all that took place up to and including the moment of exchange of consent between the bride and groom. Both bride and groom have to obviously be male and female, and they must never have been validly married before, and they must intend to enter a faithful, a permanent and God willing fruitful union. If any one of those or all of those are missing in one or both of them, then the marriage is declared null and void. Now, Jesus makes this clear when he talks about in Matthew's gospel, you know, if a man marries a woman, divorces her, and marries another, he commits adultery, except in what case? Porneia in the Greek. Porneia is an unnatural union, a natural bond, which means, again, if a man tried to marry his sister, that would not be a valid marriage in the eyes of God or the church. They would get an annulment. If both or one of them decided they were not going to be faithful from day one, or if they decide this was not going to be a permanent thing, or if one of them never wanted children. These are all instances where it makes the moment when they said, I do, invalid, whether they knew it or not. That was the case. That's what the annulment process looks at. What was in the minds and the hearts of the bride and groom at the moment of the exchange of consent. So it's an ecclesiastical extension of the jurisdiction of the church, but it's not something that she could just make up, because it's very serious when Jesus says, if you know you divorce and remarry, it's adultery. That's something from the lips of Christ that we have to take fully, and yet we have to say, but when is that not the case? Well, when it's not really a sacramental marriage, because then it's not until death.
James is on Long Beach, New York, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130, another first-time caller. James, just a couple minutes left with Father Trujillo. What's your question today?
Good afternoon, Father. I heard you speaking with the woman who asked about Mary Magdalene being told by Jesus not to touch him. And my understanding, if I recall the gospel correctly, he said to Mary Magdalene, don't touch me because I have not yet gone to the Father. Okay. And later on, when he's in the upper room with the 12, with the apostles, he has already been to the Father and returned to earth in a glorified body. I'm wondering if that's an interpretation that holds up as to why the dichotomy between Mary Magdalene touching him and Thomas touching him.
Well, that's a good hypothesis. However, I think Jesus does not go to the Father until his ascension. When he rises from the dead on Easter Sunday, he's now on earth for the next 40 days. Regardless of when you celebrate Ascension Thursday in your diocese. So when he says, I got to go to my Father, I think it's the context of Mary Magdalene as opposed to chronological, that if St. Thomas had been there, would he have said the same thing? Possibly, because, it's the context of who he's speaking to and why they're approaching, whereas in the upper room, Thomas, again, one of the apostles, his job is to go out and to proclaim the good news. It's important that he truly believe.
And Lee is a Protestant, and he wants to know if you have any resources to recommend on the Catholic and Protestant division.
certainly there are a number of so many authors. Christopher Dawson, I think, is an excellent author, gives you a nice context historically of what how the Reformation began, what precipitated it, the Counter-Reformation. He's one of my most loyal, I've endorsed him completely, church historians. There's a couple others that escape my mind right now because I'm at that age where things slip out. Hitchcock, James Hitchcock, has a good book, church history. Because that's basically what you want to see is how historically this came about, but also that document I mentioned before, that Dominus Iesus, gives you a good theological perspective.
Father, would you leave us with a blessing?
Benedicat vos omnipotens Deus, Pater, et Filius, et Spiritus Sanctus. Amen.
On behalf of our host, Father John Trigilio, producer Michael McCall, call screener Matt Kubensky, and our social media maven, Mr. Ace McKay, I'm Jack Williams. Thanks so much for tuning in. Back at it tomorrow with Father Wade. Until then, God bless.